Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now the tunnels you take for granted, how New York's remarkable water system really works. David Saul, an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, has dug through the archives and written a new book, Empire of Water, an environmental and political history of the New York City water supply. He joins me now. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Are you a New Yorker originally?
I am. I was born in Brooklyn, but fortunately or unfortunately, my family left when I was about 6 or 7 years old. So the project was somewhat of a homecoming for me.
So what got you interested in this?
Well, a couple of things got me interested. I think the main thing was that there had been a fair amount written about the New York City water supply, but not much from an environmental perspective. So a lot of it was about the technological achievements of building the tunnels, which is a really important story, but there's a whole bunch of other implications that stem from that. So I was interested in that.
And the other thing that people talk about all the time is the good taste of the drinking water in New York City, that it's relatively clean, that it doesn't need a filtration plant. That was a big issue for a time, but the EPA declared it clean enough, and it tastes good, and it apparently isn't making many people sick.
Yeah, and the filtration story is really the big story, and that was really the entree, the thing that got me interested. In 1997, the city, the state, the federal government, folks up in the Catskills where most of the water comes from, agreed to really probably the most important watershed protection program in the United States, and that is what ensured that New York would not have to filter most of its water. And that was an amazing political story. And that was really, I really wanted to explore that story. And that's mostly what got me interested in pursuing it.
So the water comes to New York City from reservoirs that are varying number of miles north of the city line. And it was development in the New York City watershed, the lower Hudson Valley, more or less, that was starting to encroach on the margins that would definitely keep the city free of needing filtration in the late 90s. So there was this whole big compromise, which is a lot of what the book is about, between New York City and some of its northern neighbors on how much they could actually develop there, right?
Yeah, and that was the fundamental question. And the really interesting part of the story, for me at least, was how New York City figured out how to cooperate with these folks who, quite honestly, hated New York. You have to remember, New York built 6 reservoirs in the Catskills from about 1905 to the late 1960s, and not surprisingly, this caused a tremendous amount of resentment. A lot of people who live there have parents, grandparents, other relatives who lost their homes or businesses. And so it was a situation where New York had to go in and negotiate with people who bore it a lot of ill will. And so that story was really compelling to me.
Listeners, anybody want to call in? We used to take calls on this in the late 90s. This show is on the air already. And people would call and say, I really live in Brooklyn, but I also have a home in the Catskills, and the city is really being imperialist about this, and I have a right to my property. And there were all kinds of conversations like that. So I wonder if anybody who does have property around the reservoirs is listening right now and wants to reflect on how that 1997 watershed management agreement has been working out, in your opinion. Is it too restrictive in any way? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. For David Saul, who has written Empire of Water, an Environmental and Political History of the New York City Water Supply. And it's funny, David, for all that that was a huge issue at that time, I don't think I've heard a peep out of anybody since. There hasn't been a movement that I know of to go back to the legislature in Albany or anywhere else and say, this is so restrictive, we can't really live like this, New York is still being imperialist, we have to try to overturn this agreement. Of course, there was a lot of money that was going to flow to these communities. But I don't see that there's a lot of dissatisfaction, at least that's come to the surface to my attention.
Yeah, I mean, so a lot of this has been behind the scenes. There was a fair amount of dissatisfaction about acquisition of land, because one of the really important aspects of the agreement was that New York had to solicit landowners around these reservoirs to purchase some of the property, the idea being that if the property stayed undeveloped, that would protect the water supply. So New York has acquired tens of thousands, I think it's now probably over 100,000 acres in the Catskills in the last 10 to 15 years or so. So it's a pretty significant amount of property. And some of the folks in the Catskills were concerned because a lot of the land that was acquired was not very close to the reservoirs. And it wasn't clear that there was really a connection to water quality. How was buying land, say, 30 miles from the reservoir really going to affect water quality? And so there was a lot of pushback by some of the folks up in the Catskills. And a lot of this was behind the scenes, and there were some lawsuits and threats of lawsuits. But ultimately, the two sides came together and sort of narrowed the criteria that New York would use when acquiring land. And so part of it is, you're right, it's not on the front pages. It is definitely sort of behind the scenes. And so relations have improved, but things are not, you know, 100% copacetic.
How unusual is this as a way of getting water for a big city or urban area to actually own land in reservoirs that are, you know, dozens of miles away from that city, and to have the right to impose environmental protections on that area? Is this unique to New York, or is this a pattern that repeats around the country or around the world, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say it's somewhat unique. Certainly, you mentioned filtration. And so one of the unique aspects of the New York system is that most of the water, that is the water that's coming from the Catskills, is not filtered because it meets federal water quality standards, primarily because there are low populations in the Catskills and because the city's taken steps to prevent pollution. And that's what the whole memorandum of agreement from 1997 is about. But there are many cities that are taking water. So San Francisco, Los Angeles built long-distance water delivery systems around the same time that New York started on the Catskill system, so the early 20th century. What's different and unique about New York is that for these western cities, a lot of the land is owned by the federal government. It's a national forest or otherwise protected. So the cities didn't have to do that much and really deal with the folks who live there, because there weren't that many people who live there. The Catskills, as New Yorkers know, right, they go up on the weekends, many cases, don't have a large year-round population, but there's a lot of activity, particularly in the summer months. And so what makes New York unique is that they have to negotiate this relationship with an existing population, which many other long-distance water supplies really don't have to.
So the fact that there are so many pristine hiking trails so close to the city isn't just a happy accident. Suburban sprawl isn't allowed within the watershed to the extent that it is in many other places. Farming, does the locavore movement owe its access to local produce on the fact that the watershed agreement favors farming over development? Either of those things?
Yeah, there's definitely a connection to the local food movement. I mean, and not only the local food movement, but also just the persistence of agriculture in the area. Certainly, agriculture in the Catskills, as in many other areas, has taken a shot. The locavore movement has helped buck it up a little bit. But one of the really interesting things that happened as part of the agreement was that New York City put a lot of money into sort of re-engineering a lot of these farms. A lot of the farms stopped applying so much manure and chemicals and found less capital-intensive ways to farm. And that's one of the, I think, unsung sort of stories of the New York Water Agreement, is the way that agriculture changed in the Catskills. And yes, the dairy industry has declined there, but it still exists and then has had some resurgence from some of these locavore kind of farms.
David Saul, author of Empire of Water, an environmental and political history of the New York City water supply. Josh in Manhattan, you're on the air. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thank you so much.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm calling because I know that Schoharie County, which is, I guess, always perennially under threat of the Gilboa Dam mm-hmm. bursting, and I know that there's a lot of residents there that really take issue with the city for not maintaining the dam, and I wondered if your guest might have anything to say about that.
Are you familiar with that in particular?
I'm familiar with that a little bit. I can say something more generally about maintenance. And so you mentioned that these things aren't on the front page, but at the same time, one of the really challenging tasks for the city is to figure out how to maintain all of these properties that it developed. Folks may have heard about the leaks in the Delaware Aqueduct, and the city has sent some submersible robots and other things down to probe the extent of the leaks. And in another probably 10 years or so, they're going to undertake a project where they're going to have to basically re-engineer part of the aqueduct that's leaking, build a bypass around the section, one of the sections that's leaking. This is going to be a major, major project for New York in terms of financial impact and the amount of planning that's required to ensure that an adequate water supply is coming into the city while these repairs are being done. So one of the sort of mundane tasks is just figuring out how to maintain this incredibly vast system. And that was one of the reasons why New York was so resistant to building a filtration plant. It wasn't only the initial cost of the plant. It was the annual operating cost of $400 or $500 million that would have been required.
Christine in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Christine.
Hi there. I'm just concerned, having visited a friend of mine who has a house near a reservoir upstate, at what the speaker talks about policies of buying land near reservoirs and how pointless it is to buy land far away from reservoirs. It leads me to believe that he doesn't, frankly, understand how water systems work, and you would be concerned about protecting rivers and streams that are leading into the reservoirs. So land along rivers and streams, not necessarily near the reservoirs, is the important issue. What's going on that's pouring into the rivers and streams? What material is being produced in those areas, and what should be protected there?
Right. Christine, thank you. So are there particular restrictions on homeowners who do have homes in the watershed, and businesses for that matter, that don't pertain elsewhere?
There certainly are. And part of the idea behind the program is that it's attempting to compensate homeowners for some of those additional burdens. And I just want to respond. I didn't mean to imply that purchasing land that's not close to the reservoirs is not important, right? Clearly, the caller is correct that the issue is protecting the watersheds and the streams that flow into the Delaware River and the other water sources that provide water to the city. The issue for the folks who live up in the Catskills is the percentage of land that's been purchased that seems fairly remote and seems less significant for actually improving water quality. And that was the nature of the dispute. Certainly we have to protect the watersheds, and that's the whole basis for the memorandum of agreement.
We have about a minute left. Very briefly, on fracking, I don't know if you touch on that very much, but as the fracking debate continues in New York State with respect to further upstate in western New York, it seems to be a settled issue, seems to be, that they won't frack around the New York City watershed. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding, and, you know, that's been a really interesting issue, and there are some areas where fracking's going on or is potentially going to happen that now wish that they were also in the watershed, which to me is a really interesting irony. You had many people in the watershed lamenting the fact that they had these restrictions on their lives by virtue of being in the watershed, and now that the fracking issue has popped up, you have some other folks who now wish maybe the watershed were a little bit bigger and it encompassed them. So I think it's an interesting to see how that'll play out. But it seems pretty clear that fracking will not happen in the New York City watershed.
David Saul, assistant professor at the Watershed Institute for Collaborative Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He has written the book Empire of Water, an Environmental and Political History of the New York City Water Supply. Thanks so much. Really interesting.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.